Just one time in the formal national existence of the United States has this country ever invaded another country and carried back its ruler to the U.S. to face trial and imprisonment for violations of American law that were committed on that ruler's home ground. This happened in 1989, when 20,000 American troops invaded Panama and arrested Manuel Noriega. He is, to this day, the only officially recognized prisoner of war held by this country under the rules of the Geneva Convention. How this all happened to be, how it came about, is the subject of a book that we'll be talking about here this morning in this part of Focus 580. The title of the book is Shooting the Moon, The True Story of an American Manhunt Unlike Any Other Ever. It's published by Little Brown, and our guest is the author. His name is David Harris. He's written a number of books. He's been a contributing editor at The New York Times Magazine and Rolling Stone. Perhaps people remember him for his opposition to the war in Vietnam. He ended up going to jail for draft resistance in the 60s. He's talking with us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. Anyone's welcome to join the program here. We just ask people to try to be brief so we can work in as many folks as possible, but anybody can call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere you can hear us. So you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel, that's 800-222-9455. Again, if you match the letters on the numbers on the phone, you get WILL. So 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Harris, hello.
Indeed, hi.
Thanks for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
In the book, you explained that there had to be three preconditions in place for this for the indictment of Noriega to come about. And the first of those being that the law here in the United States had already to be on Mr. Noriega's trail. And perhaps we start there because I'm sure people would think, well, you know, we knew enough about a lot of drug dealers out there in the world. Why is it, though, that we picked this guy to go after?
Well, there is no kind of comprehensive why that one would expect. You know, you think, oh, here's a singular incident in American history. There must have been some overarching intelligence there deciding that it was time we went after Manuel Noriega. And quite the contrary. This case began as simply run-of-the-mill lead in a standard drug investigation down in Miami, where a small clue came into the hands of a couple DEA agents who decided to pursue it, and it led all the way up to Noriega. But there was no decision on the parts of the higher-ups in the United States that they wanted to go get Noriega, quite the contrary.
In fact, I think you point out that when this case started out, this case that came to be known as the United States versus Manuel Noriega, his name wasn't on it at all. It wasn't about him. It was about our interest in going after members of the Medellin cartel.
Absolutely. This was, and the prosecutor who made the case to this day considers it one of the three cases he made against the Medellin cartel, that Noriega was almost incidental to it. But his charge was to go as far up the cocaine ladder as he could and find the biggest fish he could and prosecute them. And that turned out to be Noriega. But his involvement in being prosecuted was almost by accident. It was simply something that was stumbled upon and then pursued against the wishes of the bureaucracy over the heads of the investigators who made it.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you describe it, so we talked about one precondition being the fact that the law was interested in him already. The second precondition, the fact that his friends, we'll put that in quotes, were in no position to prevent the prosecution. And here with people we're talking about are men like William Casey, who was head of the CIA, Oliver North, Elliot Abrams, all real blasts from the past. I mean, hear all these names. The reason that he had connection with these men was that Mr. Noriega figured in the war that they were pursuing against the Sandinistas in Nicaragua. Yeah. What role did he have there?
Well, Noriega was often referred to historically as one of William Casey's proteges, and what Noriega provided when Casey took his war against the Contras underground and hid it from the rest of the American government after the Congress had forbidden the United States to provide any more aid to the Contra guerrillas. What Noriega provided for this secret network that Casey and North were setting up was the cover of a number of Panamanian shell corporations that allowed North to hide what he was doing. Noriega allowed Panama to be used as a transshipment point for weapons going into the Contras. Noriega provided pilots. These pilots were many of the same people who were flying drugs for the Medellin cartel were also flying weapons into the Contras, and often they were combining the two and flying weapons into the Contras and drugs out. So Noriega provided the staging area that Casey needed and was in on Casey's secret and went so far as, in fact, in one case, to provide a saboteur that was infiltrated into Nicaragua and blew up an army barracks there, and for which the Contras then claimed credit, but in fact it was a Panamanian operative that had done it. Hmm. He also had friends outside the CIA. It wasn't just Casey that was backing Noriega. He also had deep connections, ironically, inside the DEA, where, despite the fact that it was DEA agents who ended up making the case on him, at the higher levels in the Washington bureaucracy, Noriega was described by the DEA chief of intelligence as the best friend we have in Latin America. He allowed the Americans to board Panamanian ships at high seas to search them for drugs. He eliminated his domestic marijuana crop at DEA insistence. He allowed the DEA access to information inside the Panamanian banking industry that was forbidden them under Panamanian law. And finally, Noriega had great friends at the Department of Defense, principally because of his willingness to allow the Southern Command, which was the American military operation in the Panama Canal Zone, to exist and operate far outside the limitations imposed on it by the Panamanian Canal Treaties. According to those treaties, the American forces in the Canal Zone were to be used only for defending the canal, when in fact the American forces there ran a hemisphere-wide intelligence network out of the Canal Zone. They were essentially running the command and control operations for civil wars in Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras, and going far beyond the limitations that were supposed to be imposed on them. So he was a real sweetheart deal as a landlord for our military bases there. And that made the Department of Defense, while not a great fan of Noriega's per se, made them quite willing to put up with him in order for the other good stuff that he brought.
Hmm. Well, the reason that the first group of friends, Casey, North, Abrams, turned out to be unable to help the general or perhaps prevent his indictment was that their clandestine operation to supply the Contras in violation of the law came to light, and so these guys were no longer in a position to help Noriega or prevent the DEA from going after him. But why is it that the DEA and the Department of Defense seems to have abandoned Mr. Noriega as well?
Well, they were put in a politically extremely difficult position by a couple of developments. First, by the way the case was handled in Miami. Now, these agents who made the case in Miami hid it literally from their superiors up the chain of command until after it had gone in front of the grand jury, and it was too late for this to be unplugged quietly and cleanly. Once in front of the grand jury, it became an official legal process, and it was extremely difficult to try and short-circuit. The second thing was that the Iran-Contra scandal, which erupted when North's operations were finally revealed to the public by a series of circumstances, made it impossible for anybody in Washington to stand up for Noriega. It was suddenly what was going on in Central America was subject to extreme scrutiny, and nobody wanted to be in the position of defending this thug down in Panama. So that where in previous eras they might have stepped in and intervened to short-circuit this indictment, they didn't feel they had the political room to do so, although they did as much as they could, and a lot of that was foot-dragging. And certainly that it took till late 1989 for an invasion to happen to go seize Noriega was in large part due to the opposition of the Department of Defense inside the Reagan administration.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, David Harris, we're talking about what you will find in his recent book, Shooting the Moon, The True Story of an American Manhunt Unlike Any Other Ever. That's the title and subtitle, published by Little Brown, and it looks at the prosecution of Manuel Noriega. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. We've talked about, mentioned the fact that there are these three preconditions, things that had to be in place for this to go ahead. And the third one, and maybe the most important one for the people in the government who were trying to make the case against Noriega, was they had to have a witness, somebody who had been on the inside who would be prepared to give them information and testify against Noriega. And that person turned out to be Floyd Carlton. Who is Floyd Carlton?
Well, Floyd Carlton's a Panamanian native with an American father, Panamanian mother, who first met Manuel Noriega when Noriega was a young officer in the Chiriquí province in Panama. And the two of them became drinking buddies at that time, and Carlton attached himself as a kind of tick bird to Noriega's rhinoceros and moved on up the ladder with Noriega as he rose in the Panamanian Defense Force. Carlton became a pilot, and when Noriega became the chief of intelligence in the Panamanian Defense Force, Carlson started flying weapons into first the insurgency against Somoza in Nicaragua at Noriega's behest, and later into El Salvador. And as Noriega developed a thriving business in shipping weapons around Central America, and with Noriega's rise, so went Carlton's fortunes, till he became a very rich man by Panamanian standards, and expanded beyond the guns into drugs, not simply with Manuel Noriega, but directly with the Medellin cartel, and had developed by 1985 a well-functioning network that was moving large amounts of cocaine through Central America and on the United States, and large amounts of money back from the United States to Panama for it to be laundered.
Hmm. Well, clearly, Mr. Carlton had a couple of interests here. One, of course, was to deal with charges against him. So by turning and being a witness for the government, then he was dealing with that. But there was also apparently some he had some sort of grudge going against Mr. Noriega.
Well, Carlton's ring had been busted in the United States, and Carlton was about to become a fugitive from the United States government. At the same time, his best friend, a man named Cesar Rodriguez, who was also one of Noriega's best friends, they were kind of a trio, these three guys, Rodriguez and Carlton and Noriega, was killed in the middle of a dope deal in Colombia, executed out in the jungle. And Carlton became convinced that Noriega had been behind this, because Rodriguez had been threatening to blackmail Noriega with his criminal activities, and had in fact gone so far as to tape his phone conversations with Noriega. And then on top of that, later to reveal to Noriega that he had taped the conversation. So Carlton became convinced that it was Noriega who was responsible for Cesar's death, and held that against him. And it was apparent at this point to Carlton that Noriega was not going to help him with his legal difficulties. And at that point, he decided to flip, which, of course, is the standard investigative procedure that's used in most of these cases. More than 90% of them are solved because they convince somebody facing charges to exchange a reduction in their charges for information on someone else. And in this case, the someone else was Manuel Noriega. And Carlton, once he was extradited from Central America, was brought back to Miami and kept in a high-security cell that is underground beneath one of the federal courthouses in Miami, where he proceeded day after day after day to give an extraordinary amount of information about Noriega and his dealings, and, among other things, provided the core of the case that was used against Noriega, which was essentially that Noriega had taken payoffs in the early 1980s from the Medellin cartel to look the other way while their cocaine was transshipped through Panama to the United States.
Yeah, so he was clearly interested in, because he was in trouble, he was wanting to make a deal with the government, wanted to get into the witness protection program. There's a great segment of the book where you tell the story of how he's they're in the process of trying to set up this deal with him, and that he not only did he want them to get his wife and his children out of Panama and get them into the witness protection program, he also wanted the nanny.
Yeah, he insisted on his children's nanny as a condition of his cooperation, because essentially his wife was insisting upon it, and he was a man that is hopelessly in love with his wife, although there's some question whether she was hopelessly in love with him, because she proceeded to divorce him not long after he got into this adventure with the DEA. But certainly this was a man who named his conditions and got them, as many others did. In making this accumulated case against Manuel Noriega, the United States government forgave several life sentences and about 1,500 years worth of other sentences on some dozen different witnesses, all in order to be able to get Manuel Noriega behind bars for 30 years.
Mm-hmm. So I guess actually, this is jumping ahead a little bit, he did end up going into the witness protection program in his somewhere. I guess nobody really knows, but his wife didn't go with him.
No, she backed out, and I gather is still in Panama while he is in the United States, although with witness protection, you can't even get the government to admit that someone is in witness protection or that there is such a thing as witness protection.
Mm-hmm.
They are totally mum on the subject, but it's my understanding that he's somewhere in South Florida.
You, a little bit earlier, were talking about the fact that the people who were conducting the investigation and putting it together and wanted to get the indictment managed to keep it so quiet that it came as a surprise to the people at DEA and defense. But there was some word of what was going on did, in fact, manage to get out to the point that there were a few newspaper stories. There was apparently a story in the LA Times which caught the attention of Panama's consul in New York, a man named Jose Blandon, who on one level you might have thought that he had an interest in, when you start reading the story, he had an interest in helping Mr. Noriega. But in fact, what it was that he and a number of other people back in Panama would just as soon see Mr. Noriega gone. And so he hatched this sort of plan he told Mr. Noriega one thing, he told other people something else, and that he now gets into this with this idea that maybe he can make this work to his advantage, and other people back in Panama who are opposed to Mr. Noriega and would like to nudge him out.
Yeah, Blandon becomes a key player in the development of the indictment. When he learns of there is a criminal investigation going on in southern Florida, he goes immediately to Panama and goes straight to Noriega and warns him that this could be a disaster for them, because unlike Noriega, he understood the gringo legal system well enough to know that if the grand jury came out with some kind of official action, that they would be in an impossible position in terms of being able to derail this, that it would be in an official process that they couldn't control, and that this could be disastrous for Noriega, and more importantly, as far as Blandon was concerned, disastrous for Noriega's political party, to which Blandon belonged. Blandon was kind of the left wing of that political party. He was described in American State Department cables as the leading communist theoretician in Panama, and a key political advisor to Noriega. He produces this warning for Noriega, and Noriega commissions him to go back to the United States and look and see what kind of deal he can get from the Americans that would end his legal vulnerability. Blandon takes that commission and runs with it and decides that he is now the kingmaker. And rather than just simply pursuing some kind of deal that will Noriega's direction, he begins acting as a free agent, trying to figure out a way to get Noriega out of power and his own political interest to stay in power when Noriega is gone. And that leads to his production of a plan called the Blandon Plan, which had two parts. One part was they were going to show to Noriega to get his approval. The second part was to be kept secret from Noriega, which amounted to a laundry list of all the things they had to do in order to pressure Noriega to accept the first part of the deal. And suddenly Blondon is transformed from being Noriega's ambassador, if you will, or certainly his operative, into the independent kingmaker in Panama, at least as Blondon saw it.
Mm.
So Blondon begins to play footsie with the Panamanian opposition and the opposition to Noriega in the State Department.
Yeah, and ultimately, though, the Blondon plan fails because Mr. Noriega found out about part two of this plan.
Absolutely, and apparently he found out because someone in the Pentagon sent a copy of it to his immediate underlings in the Panamanian Defense Force, telling them what was in store. And when they saw it, they were outraged because the plan involved kicking them out of the Panamanian Defense Force, among other things. And they took it to Noriega, confronted him with it, and at that point the plan collapsed. And Blondon lost his consulship in New York and turned evidence to the Noriega investigation and to several congressional committees about Noriega.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because after this point, there would have been no going home for Mr. Blondon.
No, Blondon had burnt his bridges, to say the least. Mm-hmm. And so he became a government witness instead, and a government witness of questionable credibility, ultimately. He was one that in the end, was never used in the trial against Noriega because, very frankly, the prosecutors didn't trust his veracity anymore.
We are just about at our midpoint here. I have a caller. We'll get right to others. Are certainly welcome if you'd like to call in, ask questions. We're talking this morning with journalist David Harris. He's the author of a number of books. Just to mention the titles, The League, Dreams Die Hard, The Last Stand. He's written for other publications. He's been a contributing editor at The New York Times Magazine and Rolling Stone. He is the author of this new book that covers this subject we're talking about here this morning, the prosecution of Manuel Noriega. The title of the book is Shooting the Moon, and it's published by Little Brown. Questions are certainly welcome. Folks are listening. Like to call in here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. Here's a caller to talk with in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Maybe I'm misremembering, but I thought that one of the final triggering events that brought on the invasion was Noriega's falling out. He stopped cooperating with the Contra effort, and that was sort of the final straw that brought on the invasion. And also, it seems like from some of the other things I've read that it's pretty clear that first as CIA director and then later as vice president that Bush not only was aware but was, you know, quite acquiescent with the notion of trading guns for drugs or, you know, having the same people operating those things?
Well, to deal with the first part of the question, certainly that's the way Noriega explained what precipitated the invasion, that it was his refusal to continue cooperating with the Contras that had brought it on. And certainly there was a point reached where he was no longer going to play the Contra game after this whole thing had erupted in scandal, and Casey had been felled by a brain tumor and was no longer in the picture, and North was fleeing from the White House and facing government prosecution. And at that point, Noriega saw no future in continuing to cooperate with the Contras and stopped. But there's no evidence that that was really the precipitating incident, although it certainly may have contributed to limiting his usefulness to the United States. And certainly George Bush was a man who had taken advantage of that usefulness, first as CIA director and then as part of the Contra policy when he was vice president in the Reagan administration. And Bush obviously is a key player in all of this because Bush is the guy that ultimately orders the invasion. And he enters the story in the spring of 1988 when he's started to run for president and still vice president in the Reagan administration. And suddenly, as a candidate, he develops a, quote, Noriega problem. Namely, the press starts to link Noriega and Bush, and Bush objects and claims that he has never met Noriega, nor was he ever aware of what Noriega was up to. He he had to eat those words fairly quickly when a photograph was produced showing not only that he had met Noriega, but there he was in the photograph sitting side by side with Noriega at a meeting in the Panama City airport. And there was also evidence that surfaced from the American ambassador to Panama saying that he had, in fact, briefed Bush on Noriega's drug charges and the rumors circulating about him and his cooperation with the Medellin cartel as early as 1985. So we know that Bush was far more connected than he ever wanted to admit. But when he had to admit the connection, he was faced with his political liability to the point where his political opponents had put out a bumper sticker saying, Bush and Noriega in 88, you know they can work together. And so Bush had to get Noriega off his back. And at that point, he became the principal spokesman inside the Reagan administration for refusing to cut any deals with Noriega. At the time, the Reagan administration was negotiating a possible settlement to the whole situation that would have traded Noriega's legal vulnerability for his agreement to withdraw from power in Panama. And ultimately, that deal fell through because Noriega wouldn't go with it. But at the time, it was still a live deal. Bush demanded a meeting inside the Reagan White House with the president himself and all the cabinet to hopefully reverse their dealings with Noriega, and refused to make a deal. And Reagan overruled him and said what we needed to do here was cut a deal, and sent the State Department negotiators back to cut that deal, even though they were ultimately unsuccessful. Then when Bush became president, he was faced with what we will remember as the wimp factor, where publicly there were a lot of questions being raised about George Bush as to whether he had enough hair on his chest to really be president of the United States. And ultimately, he answered that question by sending 20,000 men down to Panama to seize Noriega.
Well, he certainly did a masterful job of keeping the whole thing from, really catching up with him.
Yeah, no, far from it. It became a great forgotten historical incident, really, since it was followed so shortly by the Gulf War that there was not the kind of attention paid to this invasion of Panama as it may have deserved for being the kind of one-of-a-kind incident it was. Although, curiously, when the White House discussions about whether to send this invasion force in happened, there was no discussion about what kind of precedent they were setting. It was all about just simply the mechanics of doing it, that this might be something that could come back to haunt the United States or the rest of the world was never really discussed, although it's still out there as a possibility. You know, by the logic of what we did with Noriega, the Iranians could turn around and offended by American videos which violate Islamic law, could then seize Bill Clinton and take him back to Iran to prosecute him for having taken campaign contributions from the entertainment industry that ships these illegal anti-Islamic videos to Iran. And we would be in no legal position to object, since that's essentially the same logic we exercise.
Well, neither of the President Bushes seems to worry too much about thinking about the consequences or second-guessing their decisions. They pretty much seem to move ahead as if they know best, and then that's just the way it is, and somehow they seem to get away with it. Well, thank you very much.
My pleasure. I would point out it wasn't just the Bushes. It's most of the American culture that tends to operate in those little 15-second attention spans. The downside of that is that people get away with a whole lot when you only pay attention for 15 seconds.
As you mentioned, it was Mr. Bush, then vice president, who was seeking the Republican nomination, who didn't want to see a deal made with Noriega because it cast him in a bad light. And apparently the whole case ended up being put on hold until after the election, and Mr. Bush won. And one also wonders about where there might still have been points at which things could have changed, and whether things might have gone differently for Mr. Noriega if he had made some different decisions. And one certainly wants to question the fact that when Mr. Bush was elected, Mr. Noriega celebrated as if the fact that Ronald Reagan was no longer president and he, Mr. Noriega, was still there in Panama meant that he had won somehow.
Yeah, well, it's one of Noriega's obvious incidents of short-sightedness, which were several in the course of this story, any one of which could have changed the outcome. But he certainly expected better from George Bush than he got. He assumed that because both he and Bush were members of a very select fraternity, namely people who had run intelligence organizations, that they had something in common as a consequence, and that that commonality would ensure that he would get a different kind of treatment. And from Noriega's point of view, you know, he never believed that the United States would do this, and was, at least according to one American general who had dealings with Noriega, was in fact hurt that the United States would even go so far as to indict him, much less to send an invasion force down to arrest him. He felt that he was someone who had done what the Americans asked. When they needed something, they came to him, and he delivered. You know, when they needed in advance of the Grenada invasion in 1983, when they wanted to make contact with the Cubans, they used Noriega to make the contact. Earlier, when they were looking for a place for the Shah to land in the, other than the United States during the whole Iran hostage crisis, Noriega was part of the package in Panama that allowed the Shah to come there and made it possible. So, you know, and obviously in the whole Contra struggle, when they had wanted somebody in Central America to help them out, they had gone to Noriega, and he had responded. And by his rules, that meant that they were supposed to respond in kind, and that he got the opposite kind of treatment was unfathomable to Noriega, at least when this story started.
Our guest is David Harris, and his book is Shooting the Moon, The True Story of an American Manhunt Unlike Any Other Ever, published by Little Brown. And we are now headed into about our last 12 or 14 minutes left of the show. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Going back, we were talking about the fact that as the machinery of the Justice Department was moving along trying to prepare this indictment against Noriega, the fact that at the same time there were people in Panama that would have liked to see him gone. There were also people in Washington that would have liked to see him gone, one of those being Elliot Abrams, who was apparently decided that maybe one he could rehabilitate himself a little bit by leading the charge against Noriega. And at one point, he was talking about doing something to get rid of Noriega. And essentially, what it looks like to me is that we would help Mr. Noriega's opponents stage a coup, essentially, and we would provide some U.S. military assistance. And this plan was shot down by the Joint Chiefs, who didn't want to have anything to do with it. How was it that the thinking of the military seemed to change so much over here in a period of, I don't know, about a year or more to the point where then later on they were willing to sign on to this military operation to go in there and get Mr. Noriega?
Well, I mean, first, part of the opposition to Abrams was generated by Abrams himself. Abrams was not a guy that was well-liked. Mm. At one point, his boss, the Secretary of State, took to jokingly telling him how many cabinet officers had called him that week asking that Abrams be fired. And he was not a popular guy, and he was particularly not popular with the then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who felt that Abrams was high-handed and was obnoxious and was stepping far beyond his bounds and wanted to put him in his place so that he didn't have a lot of allies when time came that he went to the inner circles of the Reagan administration with this plan for setting up a government in exile in the Panama Canal Zone and using American troops to make a lightning excursion into Panama to seize Noriega and bring him back to the United States to stand trial. When he first brought this plan up, they relished the opportunity to rub it in his chest, as it were. And the second thing was that that point, the politics were running against invasion. Reagan was the president, and that's where the buck stopped, and Reagan had no interest in an invasion. Had made it very clear that he didn't want any kind of military action. Then when the administration's changed and Bush became president, the winds were blowing a very different direction, and the capacity to continue to resist these calls became significantly less. And finally, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs' term expired, and the new chairman came up, and that new chairman had no problems with going in after after Noriega, and that new chairman being our current Secretary of State.
Oh, Mr. Powell. General Powell.
General Powell.
Let's go here to some other callers. Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, you don't seem to put much import in the possibility that Bush merely wanted to shut Noriega up, you know. And also that this happened right after, during the same year that Tiananmen Square happened. So I think it was not only that Bush wanted to keep Noriega quiet, but he also wanted to, you know, that wimp factor thing, show China that we were capable of as great a dastardly deed as it was. In fact, more people died in Panama than died at Tiananmen Square. And in Panama, they used mass graves to get rid of the dead, whereas in China that wasn't the case. So I just wanted to hear your best argument as to why I should not believe, after all these years, that the real reason for, despite all the, you know, the despots supported by us, brutal despots supported by us all over Central and South America, why I should believe that the only reason that they went after Noriega was because Bush wanted to keep him quiet, and he succeeded in that. I mean, hasn't gone crazy yet with this the jails they put, the 23-hour in a tiny cell jail that he's in, then we'll never know what he had to say.
Well, you know, I think certainly you're absolutely right about the level of despots that we have maintained in Central America and around the world. And Noriega, in fact, looks remarkably benign when you put him against the list of people who killed 200,000 people in Guatemala or 100,000 people in El Salvador. Panama looks like a Switzerland compared to those two. But I think it's important to remember that if I were trying to shut somebody up, the last thing I would do would be grab them and put them on public trial. And Noriega constantly throughout this process has threatened that he was going to make revelations about stuff that would deny George Bush the presidency and would scandalize America and would bring down the government, etc. And he had plenty of opportunities to do so and never did.
Oh, I doubt that very much.
Well, he wrote a book.
In court, you can't just merely start expounding on, you know, your past.
No, you can't. But there are plenty of other means to get this information out. My point is, Noriega constantly threatened to pull that trigger and never did.
Our prisoners are kept from speech, making any kind of speech to a rather extreme degree, and you know, which is a real fault in our judicial system, and Noriega is one of the prime examples of that.
Well, Noriega did make a 4-hour speech to the court ultimately in his trial, and while I think he had plenty of things to say about George Bush that George Bush didn't want known, don't get me wrong, I think that this potentially earth-shattering information that he claims to have had has never surfaced yet, and it's been 10 years, and he's had plenty of opportunities to do so. So I think that there's more factors going on here than simply the desire to shut Noriega up.
I wonder what they might have threatened him with if he does divulge that stuff now that they've got him in jail. You should point out that when Bush invaded Panama, it was without congressional approval, and it violated the charters of both the Organization of American States and the United Nations as well. It's the only other country that's ever pulled anything like this is Israel.
Well, Israel certainly is a player in this story as well. But
oh, really?
You know, yeah, he one of the Noriega's principal cronies was a man named Mike Harari, who was a former Israeli Mossad agent. Quote, I put former in quotation marks. He was officially retired, although he apparently continued to have a connection and ran a significant arms business through Panama, using Israeli arms and using the good offices of Noriega. He was known in Panama as old Mr. 60% for the piece of the action he took whenever he arranged contracts with the Panamanian government, and he arranged a number of them, apparently, and also helped set up Noriega's personal security, which was all Israeli-designed and maintained. The one thing you mentioned earlier about the invasion and the use of mass graves, and I would be very careful with throwing those kind of stories around. We know that there were probably at least 400 people killed, but there have been figures used up to 4,000 and claims that they were mass graves. And there has been no evidence produced that there were such mass graves. And it's been 10 years since it happened. And Panama is a country the size of Brooklyn, and I have strong doubts whether there were mass graves that no evidence would have surfaced to hint that these, in fact, existed. If nothing else, then whoever drove the tractor to make the mass graves talking, or someone coming upon those mass graves. And, I think there's a desire to believe this about the American military presence, at least in some circles, and I think it may go beyond what in fact really happened. And so I'd be careful about throwing those figures around.
We have just a couple minutes left, and one more call I want to include in Champaign County. Line 4. Go ahead. Line 4, caller there?
Yes. I share the same skepticism of the previous caller, and the remark that Noriega made was that he had Bush by the cojones, if you will, that he wasn't. That something he said earlier was, well, he just felt he would be treated better because they were both intelligence heads. I think it does go differently than that, and I share, I think, the sentiments that he may be chilled by the fact that he still is incarcerated, and if he ever gets out, it'd be interesting to hear what his story will be. But, you know, he's a very self-serving person. It tends to be the kind that the CIA does use, and he was on the payroll for quite a while. But I, this last subject, I think it's a little journalistically over. I mean, I don't think the exhumations have been done. And when you look at the pattern of the lack of reporting, I mean, I guess look at your book to see where it goes, and it does sound like it has some interesting stories in it, but there's this body of stuff that just hasn't been looked at by the mainstream press. I mean, you go to Peter Dale Scott or Jane Hunter's Iran-Contra connection, they have a section on Noriega. It's interesting to note that Panama Deception was nominated, or maybe even won a documentary category at the Academy Awards, but was turned down by PBS, so PBS doesn't even want to handle this kind of thing. And I think it's the case for how many people died is important, and the exhumation should be done, it seems to me. But
if we can find where to, where to exhume, I mean... I think if there were some graves out there to be exhumed that we knew existed, I think they would have been exhumed.
Well, but Panama is a special place in American history. I mean, it's sort of our backyard, even more so because of the canal zone and the fact that it's been under U.S. more direct.
There's a significant lobby in Panama that has
from the beginning of the country's existence, and I just think that. And we also know that, I don't know if it's been mentioned, actually, that more cocaine is actually transshipped through Panama after the intervention than before. So that's another interesting highlight to the whole.
Yeah, in terms of what all this accomplished in the end, as the premier case in the war on drugs, is highly questionable. Obviously, Noriega was not the kind of kingpin that he was made out to be.
Well, I'll let you wrap it up. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, just maybe we're unfortunately in. We pretty much have to finish. But Mr. Noriega, he is now in jail in the United States and has been serving this sentence. How much longer does it have to run? And do we imagine that at some point he'll be let out?
Yeah, he was originally sentenced to 40 years, and that 40-year sentence was reduced to 30 years a couple years ago by the trial judge in the sentence adjustment. And with time off for good behavior, he will be released in the year 2007, having served some 17 years in American prisons at the time, setting a new record for prisoners of war along the way, assuming that he makes it that far. We don't know about his health because he won't comment about his health, but we do know that he spent a couple months out of the Miami Federal Correctional Institution in the federal prison's medical facility at Springfield, Missouri. His lawyers claimed that it was just a bad case of the flu, whatever it was. Barring some unforeseen medical development, he will be released in 2007, where he goes when he's released will be interesting to see.
Well, I guess there we'll leave it. And we want to say, Mr. Harris, thanks very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Our guest, David Harris. And if you'd like to read this book, again, the title is Shooting the Moon, The True Story of an American Manhunt Unlike Any Other Ever. And the book is published by Little Brown. It's available now out in the bookstores.